The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Are you interested in the cutting edge of investing? That means frontier and emerging markets. And would you like to get started? Or perhaps you are already investing but still have questions. Welcome to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. On today's program, we'll take a look at news, trends, and background information that you should know to become an informed investor in new and emerging opportunities. Now, here is your host, Gavin Graham.
Welcome to Emerging and Frontier Market Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. We are here each Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern, 6 a.m. Pacific, and 2 p.m. in the UK. Each week with my global roster of fund managers, analysts, and journalists, both on the ground and in major financial centers, we examine emerging and frontier market investing, try to clear up some of the misconceptions about these fast-growing but volatile asset classes, and suggest courses of action for you, the investor. I spent most of my professional life analyzing investments and hiring fund managers to handle large amounts of investors' money, and I figure I can spot the differences between promising investments and the ones that are maybe not so promising. By emerging markets, of course, we mean the BRIC countries, that's Brazil, Russia, India, and China, along with such major emerging markets as Turkey, Chile, Mexico, and the Czech Republic. Today, we'll have a couple of reports on the Russia-Ukraine situation and the effect it's having on some of the surrounding emerging economies. By frontier markets, we mean, in general, the less developed emerging economies, places like Vietnam, Nigeria, Kenya, Colombia, Kazakhstan, Ghana, Slovenia, and Botswana. Today, we'll be having a look at the major African economy, Nigeria, which is just, according to a recalculation of its GDP, replaced South Africa as the largest African economy, and Sri Lanka, the former Ceylon, as it stakes its claim to the dollars of outside investors. Now, obviously, Russia continues to be a major focus as far as investors are concerned. There are moves in the eastern part of the Ukraine over the weekend by pro-Russian forces to seize control of government offices in some of the major cities there, very similar to the start of the process in Crimea, although it does appear that there is some subsiding of international tensions, but the rhetoric continues to heat up. Yesterday, United States Secretary of State John Kerry accused Russian agents and special forces of stirring up that separatist unrest in eastern Ukraine and suggested that Russia might be preparing for a military action as a repeat of what happened in Crimea. Also, yesterday, Russia was accused by Ukraine of charging higher prices through its major company, Gazprom, than it charges other customers in Europe. In turn, Gazprom said that Ukraine was well behind in paying for its gas bills. So what does all of this mean for Russian equities that might be in BRIC funds? And also that what's the most likely outcome for you, the investor, looking at what to do in this situation? To go further with these questions, I have John Derrick on the line from US Global Advisors in San Antonio, Texas, one of our regulars. Welcome back to the program, John.
Thanks, Kevin.
I was asking whether or not people with Russian exposure in their BRIC or emerging market funds already had an underweight in Russia because of the uncertainties that the political situation there had already caused even before Ukraine.
Sure. You know, actually, I think if you look at general, like GEM-type investors, global emerging market investors, I think I think the general consensus is investors are probably overweight going into the crisis because of the cheap valuations. I think people looked at places, you know, names like Gazprom and those kind of things and made a valuation argument that you should own those things. And so I think that going into it, there was probably those large type investors were probably overweight Russia. And so since the crisis, you know, there probably has not been enough time for those really to really reposition. I mean, there may have been some of that, if they wanted to reposition. The market's obviously bounced back, you know, kind of near, where the, crisis started. So for the month of March, it kind of round tripped it almost. But definitely still a lot of uncertainties and still a lot of tail risk, in Russia right now.
That rebound we've seen, is that sort of a sigh of relief, that, in fact, things did seem to have settled down after the occupation of the Crimea, and that the sanctions that the West had imposed were very specifically targeted at individuals and institutions connected with the Russian regime rather than being general broad brush sanctions which could have severely damaged the economy?
I think that's the idea, right? I think the feeling is that things could have been worse, and so I'm just going to call it a bounce back because things didn't get worse, right? And so more or less things went as expected in that regard, and that sanctions were relatively mild. No, I'm going to say real economic impact, even though they'll have some impact. And I think the idea is that most investors felt like this would blow over the Crimean elections. You know, it appeared that, you know, most people in that region wanted to join Russia, and it was fairly peaceful, and whether it was legitimate or not. But there wasn't really a lot of real opposition. And so I think a lot of investors and observers just generally kind of felt like, well, maybe this would blow over and this would be it. I kind of think some of the developments in the last few days, though, kind of raised the question of whether that's really going to be the case. Does Russia have bigger plans for the region? Does it, you know, is it going to move into eastern Ukraine and do other things, just like, you know, actually, as you started the show talking about, you know, they have agents in there kind of stirring up trouble and stirring up anti-or pro-Russian sentiment or anti-Ukrainian sentiment and all those kind of things, or they just fabricate news stories in a kind of a classic Russian propaganda way. They just fabricate stories and then they say, see, I told you, now we need to go do this kind of thing. And so I think as far as investing in Russia, I think it's becoming more difficult. Because I think it's become a lot more unpredictable. You know, government policy, geopolitics, treatment of minority investors, you know, is becoming more and more unpredictable. And as an investor, it's much more difficult to ascertain whether, you know, it's one thing to plug some numbers into a spreadsheet and say this, you know, XYZ is cheap. But you have all these other factors, and so I think for the time being, I think a lot of investors, foreign investors, are just going to step away and to say there's too many other places to easier places to quote make money, I think that's kind of the risk for Russia right now. I think the risk is liquidity starts to dry up, and you know, Russia has a lot of isolationist type of rhetoric right now, and I think that's you know, like I said, these tail risks that are out there that may be, you know, higher probability than a lot of people are giving them right now.
Indeed, I don't think anybody at the beginning of the year would have said that we'd see the annexation of a large strategic part of a relatively well-developed economy in Europe on the horizon, and yet here we are with it as an accepted fact, apparently. Having said that, and I entirely take the point that, you know, you put Russia and Ukraine in the too hard basket. Why bother, as you've just been stating, when there are other places you can make money? Is it likely that there will be any major negative effect on the Russian economy, apart, obviously, from some drying up of liquidity, given that the sanctions were fairly specifically targeted? Are we going to see much impact on the economy? I believe the IMF and other outside observers have been downgrading their estimates for Russia's growth this year.
I believe there will be some real economic impact. You know, the Russian economy was already fairly slow and kind of in a slowing trend for most of last year. You know, I think it's very likely that Russia could see no growth at all this year. That's kind of where we're headed. So I think in that emerging market context, for most investors, if you're looking abroad, you're saying, you know, where do I want to invest? You probably want to invest in faster growing economy than the one you're in. I think if Russia were to grow 2.5-3% this year, I think that would be a very positive surprise, because it looks like it's going to go to zero. So I think that's another headwind for Russia, is that it will have some real economic consequences for the economy. And if they continue to do, more things to rattle international sentiment against them, then, you know, more sanctions could come.
If you actually are running a Russia fund, or that's more likely a BRIC fund, what does one do in terms of the weightings there? Do you actually take it down to a major underweight? Presumably you can't completely move out of Russia entirely if you are running a fund which has Russia in the name. But I presume that a number of people with those specialist funds will have been attempting to actually have a big underweight. They might have been underweight already, perhaps, but has that underweight got bigger?
Right. You know, I know for us, we went into the kind of crisis, and actually we went into the beginning of the year underweight Russia by a pretty good margin. A lot of it had to do with more of the slowing economy story and some of those kind of things. Then we've continued to reduce our exposure to Russia and allocate to other places. I know on prior shows I've talked about places like Greece and those kind of things, which come into that emerging market, are in the benchmarks and those kind of things. And so we've allocated more and more monies out of Russia and into places like Greece. We've also, I think I mentioned it, I don't know, last time or maybe the time before, but I thought Turkey was an interesting opportunity, because things were beaten up. There was a lot of political noise going on, but still a good long-term secular growth story. It's an emerging market, so you see some things that you'd rather not see, you know, whether it's protest or just bad policy, you know, ban Twitter or things like that that are just kind of silly, really. With that said, you know, Turkey's up in dollar terms up 20% over the last month. So definitely there's, you know, the elections have kind of come and gone. The situation is more or less stable. I think that kind of that longer term secular, you know, if you could focus on the long term and use these kind of dips as opportunities, those to me are much better stories right now to invest in. And so we're definitely finding opportunities in other parts of emerging Europe, which is our realm that we operate in. And so I think even though Russia has sold off here, I think this is a longer cycle where, you know, Russia really needs to feel some pain before you either get, you know, really policy change or like a leadership change, which is very unlikely. I just think we're a long way from that. I just feel like there's better opportunities in other parts of emerging Europe, even the Central European countries like Poland. Actually, if you look at, talking about GDP forecast for Russia a minute ago, but GDP forecast for basically Central and Eastern Europe continuing to go up and up, because Western Europe continues to recover, which is a story I've been talking about a long time. You're seeing positive revisions in some of these other kind of knock-on currencies. You know, if Germany's doing well, then Poland and Hungary and Czech Republic, it's all positive for them. And so so within the region, I think there's lots of things to look at, lots of interesting opportunities outside of Russia that you can find places to invest.
Now, that's an interesting distinction there, John, because as you said, Turkey also had its political issues. There were a lot of things that, as you said, didn't necessarily make one very happy as an outside investor, although I'm not sure banning Twitter would actually fall into that category. Maybe it's a good thing, but the reason for doing it obviously was pretty short term. Having said that, now, as you said, it looks as though it might actually be an attractive buying opportunity. So it's very interesting that you feel that's not the case for Russia, and that in fact investors should wait and see how things develop. So thanks very much indeed for that. We always appreciate your insights, and it is, I think, a very valid point that there are some other interesting economies in Eastern and Central Europe that are well worth looking at, even if Russia continues to be a place to avoid.
Great. Thanks, Gavin.
Thanks. We'll have you back again soon.
Thanks.
Thanks again to Don Jerick on the line from US Global Advisors in San Antonio, Texas, for that update on Russia and Russian equities. Just before we go to the break, how did the Russia-Ukraine crisis get started? Why is it important? what triggered it and what's happened to the various markets as a result. While obviously you get insight from experts like John Derrick on this program, we also have the opportunity to go into more detail in our new publication called the EFMI newsletter. We try to answer some of those questions and suggest Russia can make some more moves. But obviously that's a moving target and things do change very rapidly. If you write to info@emergingfrontier.ca or call 888-287-8229, you can find out more about Russia and the newsletter. In fact, if you wish to buy now at our discounted price of $94.99, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca/newsletter/buy. When we come back, we'll be talking to another guest on some of those other Eastern European markets that might look quite attractive despite what's happening in Russia.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
This program is produced by EFMI Media, which has become the leader in information about emerging and frontier markets investing. EFMI recently compiled the book entitled Investing in Frontier Markets: Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, set for release by John Wiley & Sons later this year, and another book, also on frontier markets, which will be on store bookshelves later in the year. We are also launching a newsletter called EFMI. For more information, email info@emergingfrontier.ca. For more news about upcoming program segments, the books we have written, or the EFMI newsletter, please email info@emergingfrontier.ca. You can call 416-944-1750.
Have you had a chance to check out Voice America's online magazine and blog, Press Pass? If you love our hosts and shows, check out articles that give an even deeper perspective. Plus topics about health and fitness, movie reviews, philosophy, business tips and tactics, spirituality, positive thought, current events, and even more about your favorite host. It's just a click away at vapresspass.com. That's vapresspass.com. VA Press Pass by Voice America. All access, all the time.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Hello, this is Emerging and Frontier Market Investing, and I'm Gavin Graham. Welcome back. In the previous segment with John Derrick of US Global, we were examining the effect of the Russia-Ukraine crisis on the Russian economy and stock market. And now we have another guest who's also become something of a regular on the program to look at the impact, or perhaps more to the point, the absence of impact of the crisis on some of Russia's neighbors. I have Peter Curley, president of DMS Funds, online from King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. Welcome back, Peter.
Good morning. Thank you for having me back.
Not at all. Well, as we were discussing just before in the break, with what's happening and continuing to happen as far as Russia and its impact on their neighbors, obviously it's very helpful to have the information that, you bring as an expert in that area, that in fact some of them are not being too badly affected. Let's check around some of the countries that might or might not have felt the impact. And Poland, I think from our last discussion, was one that you felt is actually relatively immune. Could you just flesh that out a little for maybe for listeners who, weren't listening last week?
Absolutely. What's interesting about Poland is that its economy keeps on expanding because it is looking towards the EU for its future, not towards Russia. And the second thing is that if you have a look at some of the countries like the Baltic countries, for instance, which get about 100% of its their natural gas from Russia, Poland actually gets 60%. And what's really interesting is that Poland has started getting natural gas from Germany via Russia. This is a pipeline that goes through Belarus,
yep,
through Poland, to Germany, and then back. Now they're pumping it from west to east to Poland. So they really are not directly reliant on Russia for its natural gas. So that's a big plus, and it shows up in the fact that their markets really have not taken a hit at all.
Which is interesting indeed. How much of Poland's gas is coming from Germany now? And that obviously gives it a major ability to perhaps be a little more relaxed about Russia's use of gas as an economic weapon.
Correct. About 40% right now. About 59 to 60% comes directly from Russia. But from Germany itself, it's about 40%. So Russia doesn't have as much leverage over Poland as it does over some of the other countries.
And obviously the other sources of power for Poland could be expanded. Presumably that includes coal-fired power stations and nuclear as well.
Yes, it does. And they're also looking into nuclear power.
Right.
But one of their biggest exports is coal. And so, I mean, if need be, they can always turn back to that and power their generators.
So they're
in a very strong position.
That obviously helps. And therefore, having addressed what has been a major concern for a number of countries, given their reliance on Russia as a source of energy, particularly gas, would it be fair to say that Polish equities in general are looking relatively attractive at present, and that growth in Poland, I think we discussed last time, has actually been relatively strong and is in fact increasing, the rate of GDP growth is increasing?
Yes, it is. If you look at the WIG 20, which is their the main index of the Warsaw Stock Exchange, if you have a look at the valuation of those stocks, the average valuation of the stocks is 14.41%. It's not that high at all. It's really not that high. And if you compare it to valuations of some of the other developed countries, and so I'm a great believer in Poland for not only the long term view, but also a very short and midterm view. I think Poland is a place to get into in Central Europe.
And GDP growth forecast for this year in the 3 to 4% range?
About 4%, yes, but they keep revising that. So it may turn out to be higher than 4%, but 4% is a number that I'm comfortable with, which will outdo anything else in Europe.
Indeed. That is a very attractive number compared to what else is out there in Europe, as you said. Just again to return to trade with Russia and possible effects, does the possibility of a ban by Russia of imports of pork from Poland and Lithuania hold any real potential for harm, or is that just a more, I might say, empty threats, because we have seen that sometimes Russian statements are followed up by action?
What's actually interesting is that the ban has actually been in effect for a little while because Russia was concerned of a bacteria that was in the pork. But what they did was they released that press release just to make it a little bit more, known that they had banned or were going to. They banned it as of Monday, officially. Right. But unofficially, they had banned it for a little while because of the bacteria in the pork. But it's not going to affect them at all. Not at all.
So going to the wider picture within Eastern Europe, Eastern and Central Europe, Russia is the major energy supplier. Europe has a major dependence on Russian gas, although, as we were discussing with Poland, that has been somewhat reduced by additional supply routes and alternative sources of supply. But if I hold Eastern, Central European, emerging European equities, to what extent should I be concerned that Russia might actually, as it has done in the past, substantially cut back on its gas exports?
Yes. In fact, if you had a look at the Ukraine right now, they are threatening to double the price of gas and actually collect on a $2.2 billion, outstanding bill. And, you never know Russia. I mean, they may use that as a pretext to go in and shut off gas to the Ukraine. But as long as things remain as they are right now, the financial markets in that part of the world are just going to roll their eyes and continue. I don't think it's going to have any major effect outside, unless they. I think that what's happening with the stuff that's going on in Ukraine is that most of Central and Eastern Europe has basically acceded to the fact that Russia is going to walk into eastern Ukraine, and that's baked in. So there won't be any dramatic downturn in the markets unless it becomes a bloodbath. Then all bets are off.
So you feel that the valuations in markets like Poland or Hungary or the Baltic Republic already reflects further Russian moves to come to the aid of its Russian compatriots in states like eastern Ukraine, and that they shouldn't be hit too badly in the event
right.
that it does happen.
Right.
I mean, that's an interesting statement, because given the long familiarity with Russian action, it would seem as though they are prepared for this. And the activities over the weekend with Russian activists taking over government offices in eastern Ukraine
Correct.
Did appear to be setting it up to be
yes,
a repeat of Crimea.
Yes, it is. And I think that has been basically accepted by the markets in eastern and central Europe, and probably even in developed Europe. That has been accepted because there's nothing going to stop him from doing it. It's just how bad the situation becomes. If it really deteriorates where, you know, you have a lot of bloodshed, I think that then what will happen, and you have refugees and stuff, then I think it'll be a completely different situation. But I don't think that's going to happen. What's going to happen is if all the pipelines go through eastern Ukraine. So that's what Putin wants. So and he'll probably draw a line for himself and say, all right, that's it, that's all we want, and you know, go about your business.
Mm-hmm. One can think of other sort of powerful European leaders who also made statements like that, which weren't actually followed up. But having said that, what has the effect been on the markets in, say, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland so far this year? How far are they down, or have they actually, like Russia, rebounded somewhat?
Well, I mean, if you have a look at, let's take Poland first. The main index being the WIG 20. I mean, year to date it's up 3%,
mm-hmm.
and over one year it's up 11. And today it's up about a third of a point, as I last checked, as opposed to the OMX, which is the Baltic states, and that year to date they're down about 1.46. So, and in fact Hungary is down 2% for year to date. Now, if you think that they were really adversely affected by what's going on with the Russian-Ukraine situation, that they would be really down probably 7 or 8%, you know, probably like the MICEX, which is down, what, about 10%, 10.5% this year alone?
Indeed, and having been down as much as 25% when the troops first moved into Crimea. So, as you say,
correct.
It seems from the reaction of the markets, which is people voting with their feet, or at least their money, that they're not overly concerned with what has been happening, at least as far as its direct effects on their countries are concerned.
You are correct. You're absolutely correct. As I said, unless it becomes a lot of bloodshed, then I think then all bets are off. But I don't see that happening.
Okay. Well, thanks very much indeed for that. Again, it's extremely interesting, Peter, that Poland's up 11% and the others are only down 1% or 2%.
Correct.
Vital information, and we very much appreciate your input.
Well, thank you very much for having me on again.
Not at all. Thanks to Peter Curley at DMS Funds on the line from King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, where they run the Baltic States Fund, which has been recently launched this year. Just before I go to the break, words like risk and volatility, which are obviously some of the things we have been discussing because of Russia's actions towards Crimea and Ukraine, sometimes get used interchangeably. In our new publication, the FMI newsletter, we actually make the case that they're two very separate things. Risk, in our view, being the risk of actually losing your capital irretrievably, whereas volatility is merely short-term movements in markets. And it does not necessarily mean that it's a bad investment. It merely means it's volatile. We try to explain the differences and other details about interesting emerging and frontier markets in the FMI newsletter. Please write to info@emergingfrontier.ca or call 888-287-8229. When I come back from the break, we'll be talking to someone about the possibilities of investing in Sri Lanka. Stay with us for that. Thanks.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
This program comes to you from the EFMI Media Company,
EFMI Media is one of the most comprehensive sources of information and analysis on emerging and frontier markets. EFMI Media has become a leader in knowledge, expertise, and analysis of emerging and frontier markets, both in opportunities to investigate and pitfalls to avoid. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca or call 416-944-1750. EFMI Media produces this program, researched and wrote Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, which is set for release later this year, and is currently working on a second book, also on frontier markets. EFMI also publishes a newsletter called EFMI Information and provides knowledgeable speakers on these and other topics. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca, write to info@emergingfrontier.ca, or call 416-944-1750.
Game-changing technologies and strategies are transformational, exciting, and disruptive for a reason. They shake up your status quo. They get you thinking about new ways to scale, compete, and grow. They move you in amazing new directions. You're invited to Take Your Coffee Break with Game Changers on Thursdays at 7 a.m. Pacific Time, 10 a.m. Eastern Time for our special series on the future of business. Learn how you can become the transformational leader who takes your company across the finish line as you look ahead to the next breakthrough wave of innovation. The Future of Business with Game Changers, presented by SAP on the Business Channel.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. We've covered numerous Asian frontier markets here on the program, but today we're going to have our first look at Sri Lanka. Formerly known as Ceylon, it changed its name to Sri Lanka in 1972. A long-running civil war between the Sinhalese majority and the group known as the Tamil Tigers ended in 2009, but that long-running conflict caused foreign investors to be cautious about investing in the country, and its aftermath still remains. However, a number of frontier market funds contain Sri Lankan stocks. Today we're going to look at the stock market and its characteristics. I have Dian Dedigama on the line from Colombo, Sri Lanka. He's chief executive of SoftLogic Stockbrokers in Colombo. Welcome to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing, Dian.
Thank you, Graham. Thank you. Pleasure to be on your show.
Not at all. So Sri Lanka is currently ranked as a frontier market. Is there any indication that it might be upgraded to emerging market status, as happened with Qatar and the United Emirates over the last few months? Or is it still at a stage of development, which means that it's likely that it'll be remaining in the frontier category for a while?
We feel that over the next few years, we will migrate from a frontier market to the emerging market segment, just that we need some larger companies to be listed. And in the pipeline over the next 2 years, we have seen a significant amount of companies waiting to see the right opportunity to get listed. And also there is speculation that some of the large government institutions might have a percentage of their shareholding listed in the equity markets. So if these happen over the next 2 to 3 years, we are confident that we will move from the frontier market category into the emerging markets. And also the per capita income is expected to go from the current 2,500 to about 4,800 by 2016. And this will all lead to a potential shift into that category.
Indeed. Privatizations are usually a major factor in seeing markets gain more liquidity and obviously larger size, which is one of the factors that's used for classification. So which specific stock indexes cover the Sri Lankan market?
We have two indices. One is the oil share, which covers the entire market, but the more interesting one is the S&P SL20, which is comprises the most liquid and larger market cap companies.
And the S&P index in particular, I presume it's using a similar formula to the one that it does for other markets. It's looking at the largest stocks. Would that be correct?
That is correct. That is correct. And just to emphasize how it is covered, it's the 20 large stocks by market capitalization, and they have the minimum liquidity and financial viability threshold. The counters are weighed in by adjusted market capitalization subject to a 15% cap, which employed to enhance portfolio diversification. To be eligible for inclusion, the market cap has to be minimum Sri Lankan rupees 500 million and an average daily turnover of a million. And there should be a minimum of about 10 trades a day.
So assuming that the stocks in the S&P SL20 meet these requirements, which obviously they do, how much inward investment have we seen in Sri Lanka over the last 5 years since the end of the conflict with the Tamils?
We have seen a significant amount of investment into the country through FDI investments as well as the equity market. And the last 2 years has been very interesting because we have seen about $2.8 billion FDI investment and a net equity inflow into the equity markets of $472 million. When you compare this market, that's pretty significant. And also when you take the global situation, that we are not seeing an outflow, but an inflow is more encouraging.
No, indeed, $500 million into the equity market alone is a pretty impressive number. So to finish up here, Dehan, which sectors and companies do you at SoftLogic feel would be the most interesting to investors, whether or local investors, but particularly for foreign investors thinking of investing in Sri Lanka?
Well, historically, due to the liquidity issue, we have seen, unfortunately, just two sectors which have generated interest in, and one is the banking sector, and the next one is where all the conglomerates of the larger market cap companies. So these two have been historical favorites with all the foreigners since the equity market opened up in the early 90s. But over the last 2-3 years, with the whole civil war and everything coming in to an end, and more the smaller cap companies also performing, we have seen a shift, and some of the new funds have been looking at these medium-sized companies as well, which has given the market a more variety for stock picking as well, Graham.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much indeed, Dehan. That was extremely informative and useful, and we hope we can come back to you in the not-too-distant future to talk more about Sri Lanka and the possibilities for investment.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Thanks. Our thanks to Dehan Dedigama at SoftLogic Stockbrokers in Colombo, Sri Lanka, for that look at a frontier market which may not be as well known as some of the other Asian frontier markets like Vietnam and Pakistan, but has some interesting potential, particularly with the ending of the conflict with the Tamil Tigers in 2009. So now we move from South Asia to East Asia. We're going to go from Sri Lanka over to the Philippines, where we have our regular contributor, consultant and demographics researcher, Peter Merrick, on the line for a look at the Philippines and whether or not it's another one of those countries which are going to benefit from the demographic dividend. Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets, Peter.
Thank you very much, Gavin. It's always a pleasure.
Indeed. So the Philippines, I presume, is probably in the same group of countries as Vietnam and Indonesia, which we've looked at already in terms of having a relatively young, fast-growing population, while at the same time the people in the working age group are growing pretty rapidly.
Well, the Philippines is a little different than Vietnam and Indonesia, and I'd like to share with you how so, looking at the demographic transition model. We've spoken about that before, Gavin. It has to do with it's broken into five parts. The first one is where you have a very good birth rate and you also have a high death rate, so the population stays stable. And then the second stage is where the population, the death rate decreases, but the birth rate doesn't, so you start seeing the population grow. And the third level is where the death rate decreases and the population is remaining the same. So you've got a real surge with the population. Now, the Philippines is just about to move into the fourth level where the population stabilizes, and that's really where a dividend occurs. Now, Indonesia and Vietnam, right now they are replacement level populations, so they are further on the curve and they're starting to see the benefits of the dividend. That's where you're outwardly focused, economically, you're investing in healthcare, education, the population, the birth rate is decreasing, and where more women are released into the population, and you start seeing a consumer class, you start seeing a growth in the economy. And the Philippines is just catching up to those other countries we've spoken to, Vietnam and Indonesia.
So that's, as you say, the sweet spot where you have the major portion of the population in the working age group because of a slowdown in the birth rate, and at the same time you don't have a large segment of the population of the that are in the older age bracket. I think looking at the numbers that you sent us, about 5% are in that 55 to 64 age group, and roughly the same again over 65 years of age.
Yes, it's a very young population Indonesia has. The Philippines has. It has very few older people. One of the biggest exports that Indonesia has relied on over the last few years is its people. It's got anywhere from 3 to 8 million people around the world who leave the country, go to places like the Middle East or North America to do work, and they send money back. However, that being said, Gavin, one of the great things about Indonesia, it's got a very young population. So the stress on the healthcare system is not there, because 85% of healthcare is spent on the last 5 years of life. And as you mentioned, only about 9% of the population is over the age of 65 in the Philippines. Very little when you think about it, because it's a population of over 107 million people right now. One of the issues that the Philippines has is that it has a huge unemployment rate, and it's figured that about 40% of the workforce is not in the official economy. However, as the country develops, you're going to have more and more people entering the official economy, and they're going to be contributing taxes, and they're going to want everything that we have. And the country has an internal economy, and it's quite large. It's about $500 billion every year. So it's and there's a lot of people who are moving to the cities, and that's going to cause additional demand. And again, the country is very outward focused in trying to develop international relationships and trade.
Indeed, and obviously having such a high level of English speaking, well-educated population is a big, big plus compared to a number of its potential rivals, especially with the, as you say, the number of Filipinos working overseas and overseas remittances being a very, very significant portion of the Philippines economy. One of the major indicators, though, for frontier markets moving up the curve in terms of economic development is the move from rural to urban centers. How well developed is that in the Philippines, and is it going to be a major driver of growth over the next few years?
Definitely. Right now, less than half the population lives in urban centers, and there's about 2% of the population every year is moving to urban centers. And what happens there? There has to be infrastructure developed, buildings, factories, jobs. So many things are going to happen as that happens. And that's something that a lot of international companies look for, that build infrastructure. They look for that movement from rural to city. And this is something that the Philippines is experienced. For example, when we look at North America or let's say Europe, the vast majority of people live in cities. However, in the Philippines, they don't. But they're going through that trend, and they're going to want everything that we see other people, other societies wanting when they move into urban centers. So there's going to be a lot of demand for consumer goods. There's going to be a lot of demand for infrastructure. And one of the things that you mentioned earlier, which is very, very unique with the Philippines and many of the countries we've spoken about that, don't have this history, they've got a history with Europe because at one point until 1898, they were a colony of Spain. And they were very integrated with the United States until after World War II. So they've got relationships, very strong relationships with Europe, and they also have very strong relationships with the United States, and that helps for trade.
No, that's a very important point there, Peter. And I think, you know, remembering when I first visited the Philippines in the late 80s and how much it's transformed since then from being effectively the sick man of Asia, it's been a very encouraging transformation, and it's pleased to see the demographics are playing their part there. Speak to you again soon, I'm sure.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. That was consultant and demographics researcher Peter Merrick on the outlook for the 107 million inhabitants of the Philippines, wherever they may be in the world, because of course their diaspora is one of the largest out there and is a major, major contributor to the Philippines economy. Now, one of the major factors in emerging markets is obviously the availability of cheap telephones. Mobile phones have been a major, major driver. We know that China Mobile is frequently cited as a great stock because it has exposure to the Chinese growth in mobile phone penetration. But there's another company which has over 70% of its revenues from emerging markets, including a third from India. If you wish to find out more about this exciting emerging market and frontier market opportunity, subscribe to Emerging and Frontier Markets newsletter, write to info@emergingfrontier.ca or call 888-287-8229. When we come back from the break, we'll be talking to our African correspondent, Samuel Okoja, about some of the changes in Nigeria and the outlook there. Thanks so much.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Do you like what you hear about investing in emerging and frontier markets on this program? Would you like to learn more to increase your investing effectiveness? EFMI Media also publishes a subscription-based newsletter called EFMI. We'd like to tell you more about it. Drop us an email at info@emergingfrontier.ca. We've designed EFMI as a newsletter to provide expert and up-to-date news and analysis of opportunities in the same markets that we discuss here on Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. EFMI has information and analysis that you won't find anywhere else, and you can start receiving it by emailing info@emergingfrontier.ca.
The way we do banking today continues to evolve. No longer is it just brick and mortar locations or traditional banker's hours. Today, banking is 24/7. It's in the home. It's on the go. It's digital. Tune in to Breaking Banks with Brett King for a look at how traditional banking as we know it has changed due to a loss of trust, changing economic conditions and consumer behavior, government involvement, and of course, technology. What does it all mean? Listen every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific on the Voice America Business Channel.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to the final segment of Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. As I was mentioning before the break, we heard over the weekend that by some statistical changes, Nigeria suddenly has overtaken South Africa as Africa's largest economy. That followed a recalculation of its gross domestic product that more than doubled it to almost $500 billion US in purchasing power parity terms. I have our African correspondent, Samuel Okoja, on the line from Lagos, Nigeria, to explain how that happened. Welcome back, Samuel.
Good afternoon from Lagos, Gavin. It's great to be with you again.
Thanks. So what happened here? Because it seems remarkable that almost overnight, as it were, Nigeria can suddenly double its economy. What exactly happened?
Well, Nigeria released figures confirming the oil rich country has overtaken South Africa as Africa's largest economy in terms of gross domestic product. Now, what happened was that in the past 20 years, Nigeria has never had any kind of calculation like this. And so the information we had was based on the rebasing we had in 1990. Now, the new calculation follows something called the rebasing, like I did say, and this involves updating the size of a nation's gross domestic product. And now what we have is that the size of Africa's most populous nation's economy is now estimated at $509 billion, nearly twice as high as previously thought, according to Nigeria's chief statistician, Yemi Khaled. South Africa, the long the economic front runner on the continent, it has a GDP of $315 billion. And so South Africa has taken the back seat as the second biggest economy in Africa, while Nigeria is occupying the number one spot.
Of course, Samuel, that means still in terms of GDP per capita, because Nigeria is four times as big as South Africa. South Africa is still wealthier on a per head basis, correct?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, South Africa's GDP per capita stands at over $7,000, while that of Nigeria is over 2,000. And so in terms of GDP per capita, Nigeria still lags behind.
So is South Africa going to look at rebasing its figures, or was this, as you said, specifically because Nigeria had not updated its calculation of GDP since 1990?
Well, the calculation of GDP in many countries is done periodically, like every five years. And so Nigeria's case is making this news because it hasn't done so in the past 20 years. For now, I have not heard about South Africa trying to rebase its GDP because of what Nigeria has done. However, what I can say is that South Africa has actually welcomed the news of Nigeria's rebasing, which has placed it as the number one economy in Africa. Because according to them, it's good news for the continent, which means Africa is indeed rising. So for now, there is no news about South Africa trying to do any kind of rebasing.
Indeed. So which sectors within the Nigerian economy became much more important as a result of this rebasing? Presumably some of them would be sectors that maybe didn't really exist back in 1990?
Well, interestingly, before now, Nigeria's economy used to be explained through the oil industry. But what this rebasing has revealed is that the services industry has been contributing a lot to Nigeria's GDP. Before now, the services industry was contributing a little above 20%, but now the result shows that over 50% of Nigeria's GDP comes from the services sector. And when we talk about the services sector, we're talking about the telecom sector, e-commerce, Nigeria's homegrown film industry, which is called the Nollywood, and other informal sector like cyber services, barber shops, and the rest of it.
So, sorry, go ahead, Samuel.
Okay, interestingly, in the 90s, the telecoms used to have, the whole telecom sector used to have about 300,000 lines. But now what you have is over 120 million mobile lines. And so you can see the huge growth in that sector alone. And so this is what has contributed to the new rebased figures we have now.
So just to finish up here, Samuel, as you said, people used to look at Nigeria and say, oh, it's all about oil. What percentage of GDP is now derived from the oil sector compared to previously?
Well, the oil industry's share of the GDP is now put at just 14% compared with 33% according to the old figures. Manufacturing is much larger than previously thought, and like I did say, services are booming.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much indeed, Samuel. That's been an extremely interesting explanation of the reason for Nigeria's sudden doubling of its GDP. But it all seems to make sense, given that, as you say, nobody had actually looked at GDP and the composition of GDP since 1990. Speak to you again soon.
Thank you so very much. It's great to be with you this time around and looking forward to the next edition.
Thank you, Samuel. That was our African correspondent, Samuel Okoja, explaining what's been happening in Nigeria and the reason for the increase in its GDP to over 500 billion, which, as he noted, makes it the largest economy in Africa. South Africa, previously leader, only 315 billion. So today we've covered Russia, Poland and other Eastern European countries, Sri Lanka, the Philippines and Nigeria. Next week, we'll be back again with our global roster of contributors for another series of reports. I'm Gavin Graham. Our producer is Al Emid. We're the co-authors of Investing in Frontier Markets and Frontier Markets Phenomenes, both now available in many bookstores. We're also the publishers of the EFMI newsletter that I mentioned during the program. This radio program, our books and the newsletter mean we feel we're one of the leading sources of information about emerging and frontier markets investing. For more information, please write to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Again, that's info@emergingfrontier.ca. Thanks, and please join us again next week.
Thanks for listening today to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with host Gavin Graham. Be sure to join us again next Wednesday at 6 a.m. Pacific Time, 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel for another edition. Have a profitable week.